This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In May of last year, just about a month after the Boston Marathon bombings, an FBI agent shot Ibrahim Tadashev in his Orlando, Florida apartment. The agent and two Massachusetts state police had been interrogating Tadashev about a grisly triple murder in Waltham, Mass. In 2011. The officer said that Tadashev had admitted to being at the scene of the crime along with accused Boston bomber Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Tadashev was writing his confession when he reportedly attacked his interrogators and was shot seven times.
In the encounter in the apartment, something went wrong. Did he come out with a weapon? Was there a fight?
From the photographs that were sent to me, it's evident he was shot six times to the body and once to the head, the back of the head. It looks like a finishing shot
it's
of an
because
assassination.
Because the FBI won't let that autopsy report be released. The county's happy to release
FBI
the
officials were slow to answer questions about the shooting, but promised an investigation. 11 months later, they have yet to release their findings, but an independent review released by the Florida State Attorney last week uncovered some new details on the shooting. Reporter Susan Zulkind has been following the investigation of Ibrahim Tadashev's death and his connection to the elder Tsarnaev brother for Boston Magazine. She also talked about some of the bizarre behavior, collateral damage, and unanswered questions surrounding the case for a recent episode of This American Life called Dead Men Tell No Tales. Susan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me, Virginia.
So let's start with what happened in that Waltham apartment back in September of 2011.
So the three bodies were found in three separate rooms, face down, throat slit, each in a neat pool of blood. There was a pound and a half of marijuana dumped on two of the bodies. Right in the crime scene by one of the corpses was $5,000 cash. And there was about 8.5 pounds of pot left in the apartment as well that whoever killed the victims just decided not to take.
Who were the victims?
One of them was Brendan Mess. Another one was Raphael Tekin. And the other one was my friend, Eric Wiseman. We met when we were teenagers. We had a lot of mutual friends. I grew up around here in the one town over. And at the time of his death, my father, Norman Zulkind, who's a criminal defense attorney, was representing him for a drug charge.
So he was a known pot dealer. But this didn't appear to be a standard robbery. Certainly there was money and there was marijuana left on the scene. What signaled to you that there was something else going on?
Well, this is New England. We don't see three men with their throat slit that often. And the details surrounding the case were just so unusual. There was no forced entry into the apartment. The killers left $5,000 cash. And it seems strange to me that they would go through all the effort of dumping a pound and a half of marijuana on the bodies.
So no leads on the case for many, many years. And then the investigation after the Boston bombings happens, connecting Tamerlan Tsarnaev and Ibrahim Tadashev. Tell us first how they did know each other.
One of the victims, Brendan Mess, as well as Tamerlan Tsarnaev and Ibrahim Tadashev, all worked out at the same mixed martial arts gym. So these were all three trained fighters. Ibrahim Tadashev traveled in a small, tight-knit group of Chechen friends. And Tamerlan Tsarnaev, when he was living in America, kind of traveled in between the two worlds, both in this tight-knit of Chechen friends and also with his American friends that he went to high school with.
Tamerlan Tsarnaev's name was actually brought up in the initial investigation of this, I understand. By whom and what happened?
Well, Tamerlan and Brendan Mess actually hung out a lot. They were sparring partners. And so friends of Brendan Mess gave police Tamerlan Tsarnaev's name. So on a list of Brendan Mess's best friends, of people to ask questions to. And what's so interesting about this crime is, you know, Brendan Mess was a trained fighter. There's not many people who can slit the throat of a 6'3" trained fighter. So it's curious that police never seemed to question his sparring partner, the one he fought with regularly.
And of course, this brings up the idea that had Tamerlan Tsarnaev been investigated, possibly even connected to the murders, he might be behind bars and the Boston bombings may never have happened.
I mean, if you believe the FBI's contention that Ibrahim Tadashev implicated Tamerlan Tsarnaev in this triple homicide, then yes, then you have to believe that.
Well, I guess this is the whole question behind your investigation. If you believe what the FBI said, Tamerlan Tsarnaev was killed and his brother Zohar in April the 19th. On May 22nd, so the following month, Ibrahim Tadashev shot 7 times by an FBI agent in his apartment during an interrogation. Now, law enforcement said that he had confessed to involvement in the triple murder. The circumstances have been so murky around what happened in that room that it's led to a number of conspiracy theories. What are some of the questions that have been raised?
One of the conspiracy theories surrounding the Tsarnaevs is that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was an informant working for the FBI. And this is actually something that Tamerlan Tsarnaev's defense brought forth just last week. Not that he was an informant, but the FBI asked him to be an informant when they questioned him in 2011, and then for some unknown reason didn't follow up on his trip to Dagestan. So the conspiracy theories, there's so many, but the basis of the conspiracy theory is that perhaps Ibrahim Tadashev knew too much.
So you began to investigate this, looking into this guy, Ibrahim Tadashev, also Chechen, also came to the United States later in his life. You began to ask questions and investigate everybody who knew him. We have a quick little montage that you used on your This American Life episode of some of the people that you spoke to and their impression of Ibrahim.
Well, okay, the one thing I noticed about him, he never smiled in his pictures or anything like that.
I used to see him at the mosque. He was a good guy, nice guy, like, you know, doing his prayers and all that.
Ibrahim, I never liked that dude, I'm going to be honest. He was like a douchebag.
To be honest, this guy seems like he had a temper.
He was, I can't speak how he was with somebody else, but with me, he was grateful, thoughtful husband.
He was a pretty good guy.
We are speaking with reporter Susan Zalkind. She investigated the connection between a grisly 2011 murder of 3 men and the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. She wrote about the investigation for Boston Magazine and told the story for This American Life. And that's where we got this montage of some of the people who gave impressions of Ibrahim Tadashev.
It's funny, I went looking for answers into my friend's death and ended up entering the world of his alleged killer.
And it leads you down to Florida after you find Ibrahim's girlfriend on Facebook, give her a friend request. She finally responds to you. You flew down to meet with her and you interview her and publish some of that interview on Boston Magazine's website, if I have that right. Now, just a week later, she calls you from a detention center. Here's just a clip of that conversation.
Have you been speaking to the FBI since you've been detained?
No. Oh, my gosh. Thank God, no. I don't want to talk. Maybe I don't have more problems now.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to talk. No.
Okay.
I just want to be the story. I just want to see my mom, my family. I just want to go to Russia.
Why was she detained?
The first time she was detained was while Ibrahim Tadashev was still alive. And what she told me is she'd been questioned by the FBI for several weeks at that point. And she and Ibrahim Tadashev were cooperating. But at this interview, they asked her a new question. Instead of asking questions about the Boston Marathon bombing and the Tsarnaevs, they told her they thought Ibrahim Tadashev did something else in 2011 with a knife. And that's when they asked her to basically inform on Ibrahim Tadashev to keep them updated on his activities. She told the agents she didn't know anything, he wasn't doing anything, and at that point they detained her for having an expired student visa. Ibrahim was shot 5 days later.
And she was indeed jailed because of the interview with you, or that's what she was told by the FBI, is that true?
Yeah, so she told me it was because she gave an interview to me. That's why she was being deported. I called around frantically to immigration officials, to immigration attorneys, trying to find out why she was being deported, if there was any other reason. And what I found out was because of her deferred action status, it actually was legal for her to be deported for speaking to me. People on deferred action don't have the same amount of rights as somebody who has a visa, for example.
She was not the only person in Ibrahim Tadashev's immediate surroundings who has disappeared at this time. Azer Moraliev, a young man who barely knew Ibrahim by his reckoning, was arrested, interrogated, jailed.
That's what was so interesting and honestly spooky while I was doing this reporting is Tatiana was deported. Her friend, Azer Mamad Moraliev, was held in detention, actually in a high-risk facility for a month and then later deported to Tajikistan. Ibrahim Tadashev's other friend, Kusein Taramov, left the country to go back to Russia, and he had a green card, and he was suddenly put on a no-fly list. So all these people were suddenly barred out of the country, not allowed to come back in. And I talked to a federal investigator who told me this was actually standard operating procedure in a terrorism investigation, which
so
was,
this
I guess,
wasn't a murder investigation anymore.
You know, that's where it's so confusing. And where do you draw the line? Was this a terrorist investigation or was this a murder investigation? Nowhere has it ever been alleged that Ibrahim Tadashev had anything to do with the Boston Marathon bombings. Mm-hmm. But I think at this point they were treating this case like a terrorism investigation.
We'll be back with Susan Zollkind, who investigated the connection between a grisly 2011 triple homicide and the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. So when we come back, new details on the case that were turned up by an independent investigation released just last week. That's when word of mouth continues. Please stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Boston Magazine reporter Susan Zollkind is with us, and she's discussing her investigation into a really complicated case, the possible connection between a grisly 2011 triple homicide in Waltham, Massachusetts, and the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. Her story reveals that law enforcement may have failed to adequately investigate the murders in 2011 and how the Boston Marathon bombings motivated them to look more closely at the relationship between accused bomber Tamerlan Tsarnaev and his friend Ibrahim Tadashev. Tadashev was killed by FBI agents in May of 2013, moments before he was allegedly going to write a statement implicating himself and Tsarnaev. Susan Zollkind's investigation of this interconnected story was reported in Boston Magazine and was also the subject of a recent episode of This American Life called Dead Men Tell No Tales. Now, just last week, a report of an independent investigation of the shootings by the Florida State Attorney uncovered some new details, including a copy of the confession that Tadashev was writing when he was killed. The FBI has not yet produced its report on the investigation of the events of May 2013 when Tadashev was shot, which from the outside appears to involve three law enforcement officers, a suspect, in one room, which leads to the question, what's taking so long? Susan Zollkind picks it up from here.
So what we found and what was confirmed in the reports that came out last week from a Florida state prosecutor doing an independent review into the FBI shooting of Ibrahim Tadashev, was that before that interview, law enforcement didn't have much evidence connecting Ibrahim Tadashev to this murder case. At that point, he was only a person of interest. And so what we found was it was only after he was shot, the investigators started going around to his gyms in Florida, asking for basic information about him.
They also told Ibrahim's ex-wife that they had DNA evidence that Ibrahim was involved in the Waltham murders. Now, if they had this evidence, why was he being questioned at his home instead of arrested?
Now, according to the reports that were released, the investigators didn't have enough evidence to link Ibrahim Tadashev to the crime. They were questioning him because in earlier interviews, he wasn't totally transparent about where he was in August and September of 2011.
So they may have just been bluffing with his wife.
That's totally possible. There's really no way to tell either way. It's also possible that they did have DNA evidence, but maybe it wasn't enough. Maybe it wasn't close enough to the crime scene. DNA can be telling. That's not necessarily the nail in the coffin so far as a murder case goes.
So you spoke with David Boeri. He's from WBUR, this Boston public radio station. He's been covering crime in Boston for, 20, 30 years now. he talked to some of his law enforcement contacts who he'd either spoken to or read reports of those who were present in the room when Ibrahim Tadashev was killed. You got an account from him of what law enforcement officials said. Let's just get a glimpse of that.
In those rooms, if you've ever seen tapes of interrogations taking place, and I have, they are fraught with tension, accusation. They're pushing him. That's what interrogators do. Push him. No, I don't believe that. No, I don't believe that. You're telling me this, that, whatever. It's churning up conflict and stress. And they are trained to deal in stress when they're doing interrogations, to break down their suspect. At some point, close to midnight, according to the accounts of one of the people in that room, Tadashev said, "Look, I was there, but I didn't do the murders."
That is WBUR's David Boyeri speaking with our guest, Susan Zalkind, about the five-hour questioning that ended with the shooting of Ibrahim Tadashev by an FBI agent in Florida. Now, this FBI investigation into the shooting death has been going on for more than a year now. Susan, any revelations in this case?
Last week ended this 10 months of silence. We have the report from the Florida prosecutor, Jeff Ashton, came out, which is about 600 pages of documents related to the shooting, as well as the FBI and the DOJ report. Now, all of these reports cleared the agent in the room. They said the shooting was justified. He shot in self-defense. But they also gave a little bit more information about this confession and about what actually went on in the room. And a lot of what David Boyeri reported earlier was correct. But here's what happened. Ibrahim Tadashev didn't want to go to the police station, so they interviewed him in his home. The trooper and the agent said they were acting on the fly, so they went into his house, into his small apartment, and they were questioning him for hours. This interview started at 7:30, and finally around 10:30, he said, "Okay, I was involved, but I didn't know," and then the name is redacted, "was going to kill anybody." And about an hour or so later, that's when the agents ask him to write down his confession. Now, we're not exactly sure what Tadashev said before he was asked to write down the confession. We do know that the state troopers in the room were recording this conversation, at least in part, but they stopped recording right as Ibrahim Tadashev was writing down his confession, right at this violent point where the FBI agent and the state trooper in the room look away. And that's where Ibrahim Tadashev, who's writing on a coffee table, he picks up the coffee table, he slams the FBI agent in the head, and then instead of leaving the house, runs in the kitchen, is looking for something. He's looking through drawers, according to the accounts, and he gets a hold of a hollow pole, the handle of a mop or a broom, and starts charging at the agent and the Massachusetts state trooper in the room. And that's when the agent shoots three times. Tadashev goes down, but then he doesn't stay down. He springs up again, and that's when the agent shoots four more times, and Ibrahim Tadashev is dead.
Well, after all of this, Susan, you've done a lot of reporting, gone through a lot of different sources. Are you any more clear on whether Tadashev had anything to do with the murder of your friend back in 2011?
Well, that's what's so interesting. In the documents, in the redacted documents, after hours and hours of interviews, he said he was involved in a robbery with Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Actually, the name is redacted, but he didn't know there was going to be a murder. The confession says, "My name is Ibrahim Tadashev. I want to tell the story about the robbery me and Tam did in Waltham in September of 2011. Now, not every single word in this unredacted copy of the confession is clear, but the last four words are. And the last sentence, it says, "We put them on the ground and then," and the last four words are, "tape their hands up." Now, what's so disconcerting about this is I talked to someone who saw the crime scene, who found the bodies, and she told me that the hands weren't taped up. They weren't taped up and they weren't tied. So you asked, has there been any closure in this unsolved triple murder case of my friend? And the answer is no. In the statement from the Middlesex County District Attorney last week, it says the investigators are still trying to identify all parties responsible for that terrible incident. What that says to me is that this case isn't closed, and they're potentially looking for other people that might still be involved.
Well, many, many more questions there. Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Susan Zelkind, a reporter for Boston Magazine, who recently collaborated with This American Life on the episode called Dead Men Tell No Tales. You'll find a link to listen to it or to read Susan's story at Boston Magazine, where you will also find the original unredacted documents and photographs that she discovered during her reporting. Links to find all of that are at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For more than a decade, Julia Angwin was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, where she led a privacy investigative team. She was also part of the team that won a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of corporate corruption. In other words, she has deep and inside knowledge about who's watching you, what they know, and why it matters. Those are some of the questions answered in her new book, Dragnet Nation, a quest for privacy, security, and freedom in a world of relentless surveillance. The book thoroughly covers big data and the booming surveillance economy, as well as how Angwin attempts to escape the data dragnet herself. In a recent New York Times op-ed, she tallies the cost of protecting her personal information and asks whether privacy has become a luxury good. Julia Angwin, welcome to the program.
It's so great to be here.
You point out, if you aren't paying for the product, you are the product, and say that we used to pay for services that are now free. So how are we paying now?
Essentially, nowadays, we get for free all sorts of things that we used to buy. Mostly, I'm talking about software. When I was growing up, I went to the store, and I bought it in a package. It was shrink-wrapped, and you took it home and installed it. Now, you get your apps or your web browser for free. And so those companies need to make money some other way, and they basically make it by offering advertisers the opportunities to target you in different ways.
And this happens in Gmail, this happens in Facebook. I mean, we're probably all pretty familiar with it, but people don't seem to be all that concerned, or at least let's say they're not concerned enough to change their behavior by threats to privacy. So why are you?
Well, the thing is, we don't know the true cost of the data we're exchanging. So this isn't a very monetary exchange. It's like, I'm giving this data, but I don't know in the future, could it cost me a job if it's somehow used against me, or could it cost me my insurance? So the problem is we don't have a good sense of what the data is truly worth, which is what causes uncertainty.
You wrote in your op-ed, last year I spent more than $2,200 and countless hours trying to protect my privacy. Can you bring us through some of the steps you have taken to protect your data?
Sure. I mean, some of my steps were free, I would like to point out. So I did use, for instance, free software that protects my web browsing from being tracked by the advertisers that want to track you online. And I used some free software that anonymizes your location. It's called Tor, and basically makes it look like you're browsing from some place where you're not. But I also had to spend a lot of money on things that were very expensive. I got a separate phone, a burner phone that wasn't in my name, because essentially my phone is the perfect tracking device, and having it with me all the time, I realized that there wasn't that much I could do about it other than remove my name from it. So I basically got a phone paid with a fake name, and so that was very expensive to have a separate phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, similarly, I got a cloud. Instead of using Google Docs, I paid $200 for an encrypted cloud service where the data is encrypted and only I can unlock it. So the company that stores it doesn't have any access to looking at it.
Mm-hmm. You paid for a privacy filter to shield your laptop screen from other voyeurs, a subscription for a portable internet service to bypass untrusted connections, $5 a month service to give you disposable email name and address. You're introducing many readers to the personal data protection market. Is this a reliable market yet? You found that some of them were not so.
Yeah, so it's unfortunate. This is a very new market, and I was thrilled to find that there were companies that would sell me some privacy products. But then I was really disappointed when some of them didn't pan out. So, for instance, I paid this company, Trusted ID, $35 to opt me out of the biggest data brokers, mostly because these companies make it very difficult to remove your data from them, and they're not well-known companies. And I thought these people had a service. It might be easier than me sitting here and faxing them my driver's license and whatever else they wanted. But the problem was I paid the money, I waited a couple months, and then I thought, I wonder if this worked. How can I check? There's not really a way to check because these data brokers don't actually offer you access to your data. So essentially I called them as a reporter, each one, and said, did you opt me out? And unfortunately, I had been opted out of less than half of them.
How does the economy for those kind of devices and services stack up against what you call the surveillance economy?
Well, the thing is that we as citizens and consumers are just underfunded in the arms race over surveillance technology. So as much as I tried to buy my way into the best technology or find some of the free tools that are really powerful, I'm not going to be able to compete with Google or the government. And so I just felt like this was an arms race that I was destined to lose.
You're an award-winning investigative reporter, Julia, but you carry a burner phone and a wallet lined with metallic film. I mean, should the rest of us be concerned or even scared?
I mean, I think that it's important for people to figure out what they're worried about and focus on that threat. You know, I sort of tried to address a whole range of threats so that people could sort of see what it took to protect their privacy. So on the phone front, I used the burner phone. I also had a bag that I put my phone in that blocks all the signals. You know, but some people might prefer what I did online in terms of switching off of Google search onto another search engine, DuckDuckGo. That might be the thing they're more concerned about, that their searches are not stored forever. So I hope that people will think about it and realize that whatever the thing they're worried about, there is probably a choice.
But this book was started long before revelations of NSA surveillance program. I'm not sure if you had any ideas about it, but do you feel like what people need to know has changed dramatically since you even started this book?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one thing that is amazing is that, you know, people who follow this industry kind of thought that these things that Snowden mentioned were happening, but we didn't have any proof, right? There had been hints about the phone database collection. There had been some talk about the 702 PRISM program, but nobody really knew the scope of them. And what's been shocking to me as we've watched the revelations unfold is how under-paranoid I was, right? There was actually much more invasive stuff going on than I thought. I would never have guessed, actually, the NSA was trying to intercept the traffic from Angry Birds to the advertisers. It just didn't seem like it was going to be worth their time. And so I've been amazed that it hasn't sort of caused more people to reconsider, although maybe I'm wrong. It's hard to know right now. I think everyone's still digesting the revelations.
We're speaking with Julia Angwin. She's a senior reporter at ProPublica and author of a book called Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. She also wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about whether or not privacy has become a luxury good. You even suggest that we should cover our computer cameras when not in use. Tell us more about that.
Well, unfortunately, there are hackers out there, criminal hackers, who have come up with this clever idea of getting tricking people into clicking on some sort of link in email that installs software on their computer and allows the hackers to remotely control their camera. And so this has actually happened a number of times, that they have filmed people in their bedrooms and then sent them emails basically extorting them, saying, look, I'm going to put these pictures of you undressed online if you don't pay me. And so the fact is that the kind of software that they use is very widely available, and so I think it's just prudent to put the sticker over the computer camera unless you're using it, and then you can take the sticker off while you're using the camera. But at least you know that when it's not in use, it really is not in use.
Well, the larger question in your op-ed, of course, whether privacy will be protected only for those who can afford it. What kind of questions should we be asking as a larger culture, as we develop different technology, as we look at regulation and policy, about the cost of protection?
Well, I think of it sort of like cars. You know, we get into cars every day. They're really dangerous, but they're also incredibly useful. And we have assurances, though, that they've met some sort of minimum safety standards. And then people who want to buy a luxury car can buy sort of additional levels of safety standards. But we all have a baseline that we know is safe enough, and that also we have some rights if it it weren't a car crash, we could sue or, you know, have some litigation over whether whose fault it was. And we just don't have that baseline for privacy. And then I think it would be okay to have a luxury market. But right now, it's really just a luxury that the other people are really left behind. And it doesn't seem like a fair market.
Julia, there are people who are advocating that we as citizens can shift the playing field and somehow use our own data, data that's being gathered all over the place, and using it for our own purposes, for government accountability, for our own sort of, you know, health and wellness goals, for keeping track of contaminants in our water, for all manner of things. Do you think it is possible to actually harness all of this big data for ourselves, or are there too many interests pushing the other way?
Well, I hope that we can, because I really love the idea of getting all my data for myself and learning from it. One thing that really frustrated me in my privacy journey in my book was that I couldn't get my data. For instance, I looked at my Google search data, and it was like incredibly revealing about sort of how I go through my day, and every minute I seemed to be Googling a different thing, and it was a real record of my thoughts. And I wanted it. I thought, oh, I could analyze this. Maybe I could learn something from this big data, because they had my searches going back to 2006, but I couldn't get it. So they don't let you download it. You can sort of view it online page by page, but you can't actually take it. And so I felt that in some ways, we were fighting over the big data, right? They want to learn from my data, but they don't want me to learn from it. And I would like that to be equalized.
Julia Angwin, I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
Julia Angwin, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, now senior reporter at ProPublica. We have much more on her new book, Dragnet Nation, including excerpts from the book and interviews. It's all at wordofmouthradio.org. If you're a texter, you've probably seen an emoji. You know, those cute little pictures of smiley, winky, or frowny faces. There are more than 700 different emojis out there, and plenty of interest groups asking for more. Why, for example, is there no hot dog emoji? Turns out the answer is surprisingly complicated. We'll try and take a bite out of that quandary after the break. From NHPR, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Once dismissed as teenage fad, emojis, those smiley faces and small cartoon pictographs used in text messages, seem to be here to stay. And the range of emotion they can emote is far more vast than you might think. Last year, an 800-page emoji translation of Moby Dick was added to the Library of Congress. More recently, a video of Beyoncé's song Drunken Love went viral, with the emojis illustrating the lyrics of the song. With more than 700 different emojis available, you would think there are more than enough ways to convey a message in emoji speak. Not so, according to different groups petitioning to add emojis omitted from the lexicon. Most glaringly for Americans, the hot dog. Our guest is Caroline Porter. She wrote an article called Hot Dog Fans Campaign for the New Emoji for the Wall Street Journal and joins us now. Caroline, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Can you first give us a little history on the emoji and where it came from?
Definitely. So this was a bit of a bit of a surprise in the sense that it was an investigation. There's a fair amount of folklore surrounding the history of emoji, but what we've been able to discern is that emojis began in Japan, that there were cell phone carriers, and they realized that it was easier to text using these emojis rather than texting out the full characters, and so they started developing these different wider varieties of emoticons. And the problem is that there wasn't one uniform code to understand all the different emojis. And so different carriers had different smiley faces, if you will. And if you weren't on the right carrier, they wouldn't show up. And then when we had, you know, other tech gurus from around the world trying to communicate with folks in Japan, they realized that it was even harder. And so that's when the Unicode Consortium got involved. And the Unicode Consortium is a nonprofit that standardizes different characters on the internet. So that way, what might show up for you is the same as what would show up in other parts of the country or other parts of the world.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, is sending a smiling face from one place and, you know, turning out with a tongue sticking out probably wouldn't work in a lot of international negotiations, obviously.
Yeah.
But this idea of the Unicode Consortium, what a name. Those are the people who decide which emojis actually get a place on the keyboard?
No. So what happens is the Unicode Consortium, they standardize these different symbols and numbers into one, you know, standard code. And then the different providers, say Apple or Google, can choose what they actually put on their own devices. So that's how it kind of gets complicated, because when I went to go talk with Google or, you know, Apple, for instance, they can say, well, you know, really it's Unicode is the one who's giving us the palette with which we can decide what to offer our customers. And then when you talk to Unicode, Unicode can say, well, we have lots of different options, and it's the choice of the different cell phone carriers or the device operators to decide what they want on their own specific platforms. In this particular case, the Unicode Consortium does not have a hot dog. So that kind of came back to Unicode.
Well, may I ask, when you were investigating this, were you at all surprised at the sort of political intrigue of the emoji?
You know what I found most interesting about it was the huge response that emoji have received, the way in which that they've become their own language of sorts is pretty, you know, widespread, rampant, and perhaps Unicode didn't realize the full spread of that. And in a way, now that they're kind of questioning where is the limit, because that's what's fascinating about all of this, is that it comes at the crossroads of the modern technology and modern communication, and who controls that and where are the restrictions. It's nebulous and still being, you know, those boundaries are still being defined.
Well, Caroline, I guess I have to get back to the central issue here, which is that there is no hot dog emoji.
Right.
Now, what would it take to get a hot dog emoji?
So I asked that question of one of the co-founders of Unicode, and his response, which is like they have a general rule of thumb, which is they try to standardize that which already exists. So, for instance, the reason why we have a lot of emojis that reflect a Japanese nuance is because that's what already existed. In the case of a hot dog, that would have to be a totally new creation. And so the reply was, you know, it's less certain that that's something that would happen. And, you know, he did actually joke a little bit about how the question would be, if you were to have a hot dog emoji, would you do it with ketchup? Would you do it with relish? Here, where I am, based in Chicago, we don't put ketchup on hot dogs. So, you know.
Wouldn't it just take a graphic designer 3 minutes to design a hot dog emoji?
Well, it's much more complicated than that in terms of like the coding, and there's different fonts, and, you know, there's a whole world behind this that makes it a much more laborious process. But to your point, I think that there is this other question going on, which is at what point are we going to expand or shift in the way that we communicate with images, so that we can have a limitless number of options at our fingertips?
It is not just the hot dog. There are several groups campaigning for new emojis. Could you go through some of the other omissions that are getting quite a bit of support?
Sure. So one that's notable and that has received a lot of attention is the demand for diversity in emoji, in representations of different people. So that's definitely something that's being worked on. There's a petition by DoSomething.org, which is entitled Apple, Add More Diversity to the Emoji Keyboard. And I think the idea there is that they want to expand the reflections of people and what they actually look like. But then there were funny ones, or by funny I really mean lighthearted as well. There's a demand for a taco emoji. Cupcakes is another popular one. There are lists. If you Google, you will find them. It was one of my funnier reporting adventures to be spending time looking for these, but they're not hard to find.
The woman who is leading the hot dog emoji campaign is named Laura Ustick. She's general manager of Super Dog Drive-In. That's a hot dog restaurant in Chicago. Producer Zach Nugent spoke with her to see what she's doing to get the hot dog added to the emoji buffet of offerings.
We're using the power of social media, power of the masses, and we are working on, you know, getting other large hot dog purveyors involved. It's a secret at the moment, but we're working on getting them to, you know, do some kind of promotion and events, possibly serving the Unicode Consortium to try to influence their decision, because they are people, too, who like hot dogs.
There is a question, though, of what should be on the hot dog. Can you explain this debate a little bit?
Most importantly, it's no ketchup. We in Chicago are Chicago style all the way, which means it's mustard, relish, onion, pickle, tomato, and celery salt on a poppy seed bun. But we understand that in the world, you know, that's not the most common of toppings, but ketchup is the enemy because it changes the flavor of the dog. It has a sweet flavor. So if ketchup was to be put on the hot dog emoji, it would not represent the country's best interests.
What about us here in New England who eat red hot dogs with ketchup on them? Are we going to need to start our own campaign to get
a red hot dog?
That's
the issue, right? We feel that a hot dog with at least mustard on it, you know, that's universal for everyone. You'll have mustard at Fenway, right?
Yeah, we like mustard.
We like mustard, so that's okay. It's ketchup that is really quite the controversial topping, so we should probably stay away from that.
Okay, so what can people do who want a hot dog emoji to help?
They can join our Hot Dog Emoji Coalition on Facebook. They can sign our petition that we sent to President Barack Obama and to the emoji creator in Japan. And the more signatures, the better. And the more people talking about it, the better, and to influence the decision makers.
That is Laura Eustick. She's general manager of Super Dog Drive-In, talking there about her efforts to get a hot dog emoji in the emoji texticon, if I may. Well, Caroline, we just heard of a business using emojis, but aren't emojis just for teenagers? Should adults be communicating using little cartoony pictures?
My goodness, I couldn't begin to answer that question because I suppose it's completely personal. But from what I can tell, it seems like it is used often in personal communication. It's not necessarily the thing that you're going to use to explain your hard work or your dutiful attention to your boss, but perhaps more so to explain your excitement at the weekend with your pal.
Do you use emojis?
I do. And actually, like, the reason why I even, you know, kind of came across this in a way was because my older sister turned me on to emojis. And so now I try. It's really fun to try and communicate in only emoji every once in a while.
Well, a lot of people have taken on that challenge of using emojis. We mentioned the emoji Moby Dick translation earlier. And there's quite a fascination with communicating with emojis in our culture. Tell us a little bit about the Emoji Art and Design Show in New York City.
Right. That was really a neat thing to learn about. So back in December, they had about 30 different art projects, is my understanding, that reflected in some way the rise of emoji and the way that we deal with them in society. They even referred to the zeitgeist of emoji, which I just love. But I spoke with one of the people who worked on the project and said that it received a lot of great feedback. I think it is another example of the ways that technology is influencing our culture and the way we communicate with each other.
Well, Caroline Porter, thank you for your dedication to this hard-hitting investigation.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time.
Caroline Porter, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She wrote the article, Hot Dog Fan Campaigns for the New Emoji for The Wall Street Journal. And we have more on that and more on the Emoji Art and Design Show in New York City, where you can see an installation called The Garden of Emoji Delights and take a look at emoji wallpaper, among many other things. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. And we do have a challenge for all pet owners out there. Yesterday, producer Taylor Quimby shared a curious sound that his dog, Angel, makes. Yep, pretty much sounds like a tent being unzipped. So we're conducting some completely unscientific research and would like to hear from you. Does your pet sometimes make strange sounds? If so, go to the voice memo feature on your smartphone and hit record. Or take a video of your pet in action, then send it to us. There are step-by-step directions for doing it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth this Saturday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.